Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul, and always wonderful to spend time with you on a Wednesday afternoon. Let's have some fun together as we usually do. Let's start out looking at the calendar and the Hebrew dates and the important anniversaries that are relevant at this time. And then we'll talk a little bit about some Torah ideas about the Torah reading this week. So let's start out with today is the third day of the month of Adar Sheni in the Hebrew calendar, the 13th of March, 2024. So as we have discussed previously, the reason why we have a leap year in the Jewish calendar, because we follow the lunar calendar. The lunar calendar loses 11 days per year. It's 356 days instead of 365 days. And therefore, in order to ensure that Pesach always falls in the springtime, because Pesach in the Torah is called Chodesh Aviv, it's called the time when we, in the month of spring, when we celebrate Pesach. So we have to make sure that that's the case. And therefore, we add a leap year. There are 9 leap years every 17 years in order to ensure that Pesach remains in spring, and that corrects the 11 days we lose each year as a result of following the lunar calendar. So this year, too, is a leap year. We're in Adar Sheni, the second Adar, and we celebrate Purim in Adar Sheni. Purim is Sunday a week. We celebrate the beautiful, wonderful festival of Purim, which, please God, next week we'll talk about in much detail. So many important, powerful, essential lessons to learn in our current daily living from the festival of Purim, and there are very good reasons for that. So please God, next week we can look at that. But let's now look at some of the important dates in the beginning of the month of Adar. Monday was Rosh Chodesh Adar, was the first day of the month of Adar Sheni, and it was the yotzeit of Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra was one of the great authors within the Jewish world, one of the great geniuses that ran Klal Yisrael in the 11th century. He was born in 1089. He died in 1164. He was born in Toledo during the heart of Spain's Golden Age. And when the anti-Semitism flared up during the Inquisition in Spain, he was forced to flee to Rome and later to Egypt. He wrote dozens of books, not only on Torah subjects and Torah commentaries, but on astronomy, on astrology, and mathematics. He was one of the great leaders of the Jewish people in the times of what we call the Rishonim, that day of those early great people. The first of Adar, also Monday, was the yotzeit of Rav Shabsai HaKohen Katz. He was known as the Shach, because his commentary, his very famous commentary on Shulchan Aruch, is called Sifsei Kohen. So any Torah scholar, any rabbi who has studied the Shulchan Aruch, which is mandatory for a Torah scholar and a rabbi to study, learns this great genius commentary called the Shach, the Sifsei Kohen. And the Shach, his yotzeit was on Monday also, the first day of Adar, in 1663. So he was born in 1622, died in 1663. He lived in Poland, and he was forced to flee from Cossack pogrom. So it's an amazing thing. The Ibn Ezra and the Shach, they share a yotzeit, and they share a similar fate, the fate that the Jewish people have faced throughout the generations. They both had to flee the native lands as a result of anti-Semitism. The Ibn Ezra had to leave Spain, and the Shach had to leave Poland. He died at the age of 41 in Germany. So it's just amazing when you learn that commentary, the Shach. He was only 41 years old when he died. The genius of such a man at such a young age is quite incredible. Okay, so let's move on. Today is the third of Adar. The third of Adar is an interesting and significant date because it is the anniversary of the completion of the Second Temple in the year 350 before the Common Era. So it's an easy date to remember, 350 before the Common Era. The building of the Holy Second Temple was completed in Jerusalem, as recorded in the biblical book, in Tanakh, in Sefer Ezra. It's, if you want to look it up, it's chapter 6, verse 15 in Sefer Ezra. The rebuilding of the temple had begun under Cyrus when the Persians first took over the Babylonian Empire. Remember, this is after the story of Purim. So this is a few years after the Purim miracles, where Haman was not successful in destroying the Jewish people. He was the first dictator. They wanted to wipe out all of Klal Yisrael, Anashim Nashim V'taf, and he was a descendant of Amalek. And throughout the generations, these Jew haters reappear. We certainly have them in our times, and we see the Muslim world is virulently anti-Semitic and wants to destroy Israel and every Jew in Israel, and they have huge supporters, huge numbers all over the world, and they have these very public protests, and we see many in the West are really their proxies, you know, as we call them, the useful idiots that follow their narrative. But it's a very mistaken narrative. It's very false and not based on the facts and the reality on the ground. But anyway, we see that throughout the ages, the Jewish people, we don't like to play victim, Klal Yisrael. The Jews are a people that is an optimistic, positive people. And we like to build and we like to move forward and we like to not wallow in our misery, but rather build a better future. That's the attitude of a Jew. However, the reality is we face tremendous anti-Semitism throughout the ages, as was the case in Purim, where they wanted to destroy us, and miraculously we were successful in defeating our enemies, and Mordechai and Esther were the leaders of the Jewish people, and through their contribution, their efforts, and the tshuva that Klal Yisrael did, there was a nahafachu, everything turned around, which we'll speak about next week, please God. But so soon after that, Cyrus, who became, he took over from Ahasuerus. He was the leader of the great Persian Empire. He allowed the Jews to start rebuilding the temple. The rebuilding was then interrupted for 18 years and resumed when Darius II took over from Cyrus. Darius II was the king, and he is said to be the son of Queen Esther. So he then allowed them to resume building, and the second temple was completed on this day, the 3rd of Adar, in the year 350 before the Common Era. That is almost 1,000 years before Islam is even born, before Muhammad. And the Jewish people are now rebuilding their second temple. We've already been millennia in the land, and we continue to be so and have been ever since. We've been over 3,500 years in the land. So we are the indigenous people of the land of Israel. The Muslims, the Arabs only came much later. And so certainly it is our land, and we have every right to be in our land, and we have every right to defend ourselves in our land. The Second Temple lacked much of the glory of the First Temple. There was no Ark of the Covenant, and the daily miracles that took place in the First Temple were not present in the Second Temple. The prophets were no longer part of the scenery at Second Temple times. The Second Temple would stand for 420 years, before it was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era. Okay, so that's today. Today is the anniversary of the completion of Bayis Sheni of the Second Temple, which was a great day for the Jewish people, 2,500, almost 2,500 years ago. Tomorrow is the anniversary, is the Yotzat, the 4th of Adar, of Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin was one of the greatest Jews of the 20th century. And Begin is known very well for his achievements as being the Prime Minister of Israel and the Camp David Accords. But I think it's worthwhile talking a little bit about Begin, a little bit about his worldview, a little bit about his achievements, because he was such a powerful figure. And we still draw today on his leadership, on his views, on his approach, and on his incredible dedication to the Jewish people. Menachem Begin was born in the year 1913 He was born to Zev, Dov, and Hadassah Begin in what was then Brest-Litovsk, was part of the Russian Empire. Today, it's Brest in Belarus. He was the youngest of three children. On his mother's side, he was descended from distinguished Rabbonim. On his father was a timber merchant and one of the community leaders. His father was a passionate Zionist and an admirer of both Theodor Herzl and Zev Jabotinsky. The midwife who attended to the birth of Menachem Begin was actually the grandmother of Ariel Sharon, which is an interesting fact, by the way. Begin was very smart, and he went to Cheder until the age of 14 when he went to a regular Polish school. And he studied after school. He studied law in the University of Warsaw, where he learned to be the great orator that he was, which was a powerful tool that he used throughout his political career. During his studies, he organized a self-defense group of Jewish students to counter harassment by anti-Semites on campus. Familiar thing, isn't it? Anti-Semites on campus today, Jews throughout the world on Western campuses face terrible anti-Semitism. Well, it was the same for Menachem Begin 100 years ago when he was at the University of Warsaw, and he therefore arranged groups of Jews to defend themselves against this anti-Semitism. He graduated in 1935, and he never practiced law. At the time, he became a disciple of Zev Jabotinsky, who was the founder of the nationalist revisionist Zionist movement and its youth wing called Beitar. His rise within Beitar was rapid, and at the age of 22, he shared the dais with his mentor at the Beitar World Congress in Krakow. The pre-war Polish government actively supported Zionist youth movements. Begin's leadership qualities were quickly recognized. In 1937, he was the active head of Beitar in Czechoslovakia and became the head of the largest branch, that of Poland, soon after. As head of Beitar's Polish branch, Begin traveled among regional branches to encourage supporters to recruit new members. To save money, he stayed at the homes of Beitar members. During one such visit, he's met his future wife, Eliza. Her name was Eliza Arnold, was a maiden name, who was the daughter of the host where he was staying. The couple married on the 29th of May, 1939. Isn't that interesting? It's just a few months. 1st of September, 1939 is when World War II breaks out. So just before World War II, they get married, and they had three children, Binyamin, Leah, and Hasia. They were a real example of a couple who had a wonderful marriage. They were very, very loyal to one another and very connected. In fact, when his wife passed away in 1982, Begin was prime minister, and he entered into a depression. And later, a year later, he actually resigned because he just found it so difficult to continue operating on that level without his beloved soulmate and life partner, Eliza. In September 39, after Germany invaded Poland, Begin, in common with a large part of Warsaw's Jewish leadership, escaped to Vilna. Then it was part of eastern Poland, to avoid inevitable arrest. The town was soon occupied by the Soviet Union, but from the 28th of October 1939, it was the capital of the Republic of Lithuania. Vilna was a predominantly Polish and Jewish town. An estimated 40% of the population was Jewish. Isn't that unbelievable? When the Germans and later the Russians entered into Vilna, with the Yivo Institute located there. As a prominent pre-war Zionist and reserve status officer cadet, on the 20th of September 1940, Begin was arrested by the NKVD, the KGB, and detained to the Lukiskes prison. In later years, he wrote about his experience of being tortured. He was accused of being an agent of British imperialism and sentenced to 8 years in Soviet Gulag camps. On the 1st of June 1941, he was sent to Pokhara labor camp in Komi Republic, the northern part of eastern Russia, where he stayed until May 1942. So he was there for almost a year. Much later in life, Begin recorded and reflected upon his experiences in the interrogations and life in the camp in his memoir, White Nights. I have that book, and it's a very powerful description of the unbelievable suffering and torture that took place in these Russian labor camps. You know, the great progressive movement of communism in Russia resulted in the murder and in the torture of millions and millions of people. In July 1941, just after Germany attacked the Soviet Union, following his release under the Sikorsky-Mayski agreement between, because he was a Polish national, Begin joined the Free Polish Anders Army as a corporate officer cadet. See, what happened was after the Germans attacked Russia, so the Russians then entered into an alliance with Britain and with the United States, and Britain and the United States then pressurized the Russians to free all the Poles because the Poles were also now part of that alliance. And as a result of that, there was called the Sikorsky-Mayski Agreement, and Begin actually was a corporal in the Russian army. And as a result of that, the Allies wanted the Polish army to be released by the Russians so they could fight against the Nazis and support the Allied effort in the war. He was later sent with the Polish army to Palestine via the Persian corridor, where he arrived in May 1942. Upon arriving in Palestine, Begin, remember, it's under the British mandate. Begin, like many other Polish Jewish soldiers of the Anders army, faced the choice between remaining with the Anders army to fight Nazi Germany in Europe or staying in Palestine to fight for the establishment of a Jewish state. While he initially wished to remain in the Polish army and fight the Nazis, he was eventually persuaded to change his mind by his contacts in the Irgun, as well as Polish officers that were sympathetic to the Zionist cause. Consequently, General Michal Tokarczuk, I hope I pronounced that right, the second in command of the Polish army, issued Begin with a leave of absence without expiration, which gave Begin official permission to stay in Palestine. In December 1942, he left Anders' army and joined the Irgun. During the Holocaust, Begin's father was among the 5,000 Brest Jews rounded up by the Nazis at the end of 41. At the end of June 1941, so the Nazis had, you know, soon after they attacked in June, the attack of Operation Barbarossa was June the 23rd, 1941. So soon after that, they was right on the front lines. They were one of the first towns to be conquered by the Nazis. Begin's father was rounded up with the leaders of Brest and was, instead of being sent to a forced labor camp, they were shot or drowned in the river. His mother and elder brother Herzl were also murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. Begin became the leader of the Irgun and used militant means to force the British government to withdraw from Palestine. The pressure that was put, there was a big disagreement between the Irgun, which was the continuation of Jabotinsky's Revisionist Zionist movement, and the Haganah, who was the Labour Party's military wing, on how to deal with the British. At first, the Irgun felt that the British had to be pressurized by all means, including military means. And the Haganah felt that it would be better to not attack the British militarily, but to negotiate and compromise with them for after the war, then they would be more open to a Jewish state. But the Irgun said, we don't think that's going to happen. Just like they're not giving us a state now, and not allowing the millions of refugees to come from Europe, which is such a cruel thing. You know, it's like unbelievable. Today, you can enter into England and into Europe, and, you know, the migrants, refugees are not stopped by the military, by the navy of the European states of Britain. Back then, there was a blockade, and the British Navy was extremely aggressive and proactive to stop any Jewish refugees coming from Europe into Palestine. Unbelievable. If they weren't that way, the British, millions of Jews would have been saved from the ovens, the gas chambers of Europe. But they've very much have a complicit role to play in the Holocaust because they didn't allow Jews to come to our ancient homeland, to Israel, and they blocked them with their navy. And there are many, many different stories of ships that try to break the blockade, and the famous story of the Exodus, Leon Uris's book and the famous movie, The Exodus, which depicts that story. And so as a result, Jews couldn't go to Palestine. And the Irgun felt that this was a an act of war by the British against the Jewish people, and they therefore fought them militarily in disagreement with the Haganah. Eventually, later on, the Haganah saw that the Irgun were right and joined them, and they had joint operations, and that eventually became Tzahal after, when the State of Israel was declared. But in those early years, there was a disagreement. So Begin was the head of the Irgun, and he was actually the most wanted man by the British Empire. The British Empire offered a reward of £10,000, dead or alive, Menachem Begin. And he was a master of disguise, and he hid under various different disguises throughout the years, and he orchestrated the operations of the Irgun against the British. And there's no question that those operations put a tremendous amount of pressure on the British. They didn't target civilians. They only targeted British installations and those symbols of British rule in the Mandate. And eventually, as a result of the mayhem caused by the civil war that was going on in Palestine, the British decided to hand over the Palestine problem to the United Nations, who came up with the suggestion that there should be a partition, which, of course, the Jews accepted and the Arabs rejected back then in 1948. But a lot of that came as a result of the efforts and the pressure that Menachem Begin and his brave fighters in the Irgun put upon the British. Begin then entered politics after the State of Israel was declared. He led the opposition party for decades before being elected prime minister in 1977. So from 48, almost 30 years, 29 years, Begin was the leader of the opposition, and eventually he became the prime minister in 1977. Begin negotiated the Camp David Accords with Anwar Sadat of Egypt, for which he was awarded the 1978 Nobel Peace Prize. Begin also is remembered for his conviction to Jewish tradition. He was known to consult with great rabbis, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, when he visited the United States, and to walk to meetings on Shabbos. He kept Shabbos, and if he had big meetings, he would walk to them. And his resolve to defend the Jewish people from another Holocaust was legendary. Begin, as mentioned, had lost his family in the Holocaust, which factored greatly in his decision to bomb the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981. And Baruch Hashem, he did that, because otherwise those nuclear weapons would have been used on Israel, chas v'shalom. So Menachem Begin is remembered for his bold leadership, for his dedication to the Jewish people, for his very comprehensive understanding of Jewish history, of Jewish destiny, and of the conflict in the Middle East, based on that perspective. And it's very relevant today, too. That's why I'm talking about Menachem Begin at length. Just to remind our listeners, tomorrow is his Yotzat. He died in 1992 on the 4th of Adar, which is tomorrow, the anniversary of his passing. And even today, right, current affairs, that Israel is facing a terrible situation in Gaza. Israel was brutally attacked. There was peace before October 7th. And Hamas, which was given complete autonomy in the Gaza Strip, and they had their own Palestinian state over there. Everybody's saying two-state solution, and the Palestinian state, they had a state. In 2005, it was unilaterally given back to the Palestinians and Gaza, and they were given absolute autonomy and freedom to run their own state. What did they do? They used the billions of dollars of international aid to build up their arsenal and to build up their tunnels, and to attack Israel on October 7th, and to brutally murder and rape and kidnap men, women, and children from Israel. And so Israel has had no choice but to make sure that she does her basic right of protecting her citizens. And in order to protect her citizens going forward, they have to, Israel, Tzahal, Israeli army, has to defeat Hamas, has to completely dismantle Hamas. People say, well, you'll never stop Hamas because there'll always be as radical Islam. Radical Islam has been around for a long time and will be around for a long time. And radical Islam will not tolerate there being a Jewish state. That's just the reality and the fact. As much as we all want to hold hands and pretend that that's not the case and smile at each other, I wish it was. Israel wishes it was. Israel wishes that she could have peace, and she could join the Palestinians in building a peaceful future for their people than a prosperous future. But that is, if a person does not see the reality, they're putting themselves in great peril. And the reality is that the Palestinian people do not want peace. The Palestinian people want a peace of Israel. In fact, they want the whole of Israel. Hamas says it openly. Hamas openly says there will be another October 7th and another October 7th until we achieve our goal of liberating Palestine from the Jews. That means from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It means that the Jews will be murdered like they were on October 7th. That's what we're facing in Israel. So what are we supposed to do, you know? Cease fire and let Hamas regain its strength and regroup. That would be called suicide on behalf of Israel. And so Israel has absolutely no choice but to defeat Hamas and to build up her military and to stand her ground and to be strong and to be bold and to communicate in the only language that's understood in the Middle East, that we are not going anywhere and we are strong and powerful. And if you attack us, you will be sorry. And we will make sure that you won't be able to do that again. Israel, if Israel doesn't do that, Israel will be wiped out. So, you know, you've got a choice. Which one do you want? Israel to be wiped out or the enemies of Israel to re-strengthen themselves and to come back again and again and attack us. And that's what's happened. That's the 75 years of Israel. That has been the history. That has been the cycle. It repeats itself. Israel has no choice but to defend itself. And so when the United States puts pressure on Israel, when the Biden administration now comes and says there are red lines that Israel can't cross and, you know, the military aid and the economic aid is dependent on those things. So we remember the words of Menachem Begin, who's your side is tomorrow. Menachem Begin faced a similar situation during the war in Lebanon in the early 1980s. And at that time, American newspapers describes the meeting between Menachem Begin and the then senator from the United States, Joe Biden, who said, Biden said to Begin back then in 1982 that American aid will be withdrawn from Israel if Israel doesn't follow America's prescription for the war in Lebanon. So that's what Joe Biden said to Menachem Begin. And Begin responded in the following way. Begin said back to Biden, don't threaten us with cutting off your aid. It will not work. I am not a Jew with trembling knees. I am a proud Jew with 3,700 years of civilized history. Nobody came to our aid when we were dying in the gas chambers and ovens. Nobody came to our aid when we were striving to create our country. We paid for it. We fought for it. We died for it. We will stand by our principles. We will defend them. And when necessary, we will die for them again, with or without your aid. And that was Begin's response to Joe Biden. And that should be the same response of Prime Minister Netanyahu to Biden, that the Jewish people are here to stay, that we don't need anybody else's prescriptions and directions and limitations, and we will do what we have to do in order to ensure our survival, in order to ensure that the Jewish people will continue to live and thrive and build and prosper in the land of Israel. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
So let's move on and discuss a beautiful thing. As we discussed earlier, this is a leap year, so there's an Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni. We're in Adar Sheni now. We're on the third of Adar Sheni. And as a result of there being a leap year, so some parashas in the Torah, or sometimes you have a double parasha. The reason why you have a double parasha is if it's not a leap year, those parashas are joined together. When it is a leap year, those parashas are split, and they read on different weeks. So this year, if it's a leap year, we have parashas Pekudei. Vayakal Pekudei on a non-leap year is read together, but since this is a leap year, Pekudei is now read separately. And Pekudei. So it's not often that we have opportunities to say droshes in Parshas Pekudei. So, you know, it's a bit exciting for the Rabbonim. They can, some say it's more work, but others say it's an opportunity. So I prefer to look at it that way. So we see in Parshas Pekudei, Pekudei tells us it's really an audit of all of the materials that Moses collected from the people and were used in the sanctuary, in building the sanctuary in the desert. And he goes through each item, and we see that a responsible leader will be completely transparent and will show the public that public funds were used in a responsible way and every cent is accounted for, which is the way any public organization should be run. So he's, Moshe Rabbeinu says, Kol hazav ha'asoy l'malacha, b'chum melech zakodesh, v'yizahav ha'tnufa, teish v'eshim kikar. All the gold that was gathered was 29 kikar of gold. We're not sure exactly what that is in today's terms, but it's a large amount of gold. And 330 shekel, shekalim, in addition to that. So that's how much gold was used in the Mishkan. Now, the Sforno, the great Rabbi Avadia Sforno, says a wonderful comment on this. Sforno says, Kol hazav, it's Pasuk Chaf Dalet, if you want to look it up, Perek Lamed Ches, Heid al kitzvas hazav ha-kesef ha-nechoshesh, So Moshe Rabbeinu is testifying to all of the gold and silver that was gathered and used in the Mishkan. But we know that this amount was much less than the gold that was used for the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple that was built by King Solomon, as we learn in Sefer Malachim. And more, even more so, the building of Hurdus. So remember, we said today the third of Adar was when the second temple was completed in the year 354 the Common Era. And about 150 years later, somebody by the name of Herod, it's a long story, so we won't go into the whole story, he then renovated the second Beis HaMikdash. Remember, the second Beis HaMikdash stood for 420 years. So Herod did a tremendous renovation of the Beis HaMikdash, and he introduced a massive amount of gold. So, says the Sforno, the Mishkan in the desert had a fair amount of gold. The first temple that was built by Solomon had much more gold. And then the second temple, after it was renovated by Herod, had a huge amount of gold, much, much more than both the Mishkan in the desert and the first temple. The Imkol Zeh, and with all of this, Yoter Hatamid Mare Kavod Hashem B'Mishkan Shel Moshe B'ma Shehismid B'Mikdash Rishon. So even though that was the case, says the Sforno, Hashem appeared to Moshe in the Mishkan in the desert much more than Hashem appeared in the Mishkan of the first temple, which was under the Kohanai. There were many different Nevi'im prophets and Kohane Gedolim, there were many different Kohen Gadols at the time. So Hashem appeared much more in the first temple than he did, in the Mishkan in the desert, than he did in the first temple. But not near a club in Mikdashani, and the Shekhinah was not present at all in the second temple. So it's the inverse of the amount of gold was how much Hashem was there. B'zehura. So says the Sforno quite brilliantly. In this we learn, Shelo Kitzavta Ha'oisher v'goydol ha'binyan yusiba v'hashrosh ha'shkina b'Yisrael. The Hashem's presence amongst the Jewish people is not dependent on the amount of gold. Aval roitza Hashem es yireyav. Hashem desires those that fear Him, u'ma'aseihem l'shichna b'soicham, and their actions, their righteous deeds and actions, in order to dwell amongst them. Hashem's presence is not dependent on the opulence and the beauty of the building. Hashem's presence is dependent upon the reverence and humility of the people in that building and on their service and of their dedication and devotion to Hashem, which is such a beautiful, powerful lesson for all of us, is that Hashem wants our heart, Rachmana Liboboy, Hashem wants our hearts. As the Sforno said, Hashem wants those that have reverence and fear for Him. And we've discussed before, it's not a fear that you're frightened of the headmaster that you're going to get into trouble. It's a fear out of love. The relationship of love is so powerful that we don't want to damage that love. That's yira mi'ava, as the Shlah explains. So we fear Hashem because we love Hashem. And we have a connection to Hashem. And that's what Hashem is looking for. And when we have that humility and devotion, Hashem is amongst us. Hashem is close to us. It's when we are arrogant, and it's when we are, when we think that we are above others, and that we are self-sufficient, and that we are beyond reproach, that chases Hashem away. And so it's a beautiful concept of the Sforno that we see in the Beis HaMikdash, and it's actually a concept that is echoed by our sages. So we're going to take a very short ad break. When we come back, we'll end off with this idea, how the sages mirror this concept of the Sforno.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
So we're discussing this beautiful concept of the Sforno, that even though the amount of gold in the Mishkan was the least compared to the first Beis HaMikdash, second Beis HaMikdash, but yet Hashem's presence was there more than the others, because Hashem is not looking for opulence. Of course, the Beis HaMikdash was beautiful. Hashem wants us to have a beautiful Beis HaMikdash. Hashem wants us to have a beautiful Beis HaKnesses, it's a beautiful shul. We must build beautiful shuls and build beautiful Bate Midrashes. But that's not the Ikkah. That's not the main thing. That's Tafel, that's secondary. The main thing is what fills those buildings. And Hashem wants our heart. Hashem wants our dedication and our service and our devotion. And that's what brings Hashem there more than the gold and the beautiful buildings. And that's a consistent principle within Judaism. And it is backed up and supported by a statement of the sages. This is a vort of Rabbi Meir Shapiro. I heard it from Rabbi Fran. The great Rabbi Meir Shapiro, who started Daf Yomi, who was the great leader of Jews in Lublin in Poland. He's actually a member of parliament in Lublin in Poland. And he quotes the Gemara in the Dorim. The Gemara in the Dorim, Daf Pei Aleph, says that His haru mi b'nei aniyim shemihem teitze Torah. The Gemara says, be very careful of those people. B'nei aniyim means the children of those that are impoverished. So it means both impoverished in terms of wealth. So be careful of children who come from poor families. And also is those who are impoverished in terms of yichus, in terms of achievement, leaders, rabbonim, you know, great accomplished families. Because the Gemara says it's from those children, the children who come from humble backgrounds, mihem teitzei Torah, the Torah will emanate from them. It's an amazing statement of the Gemara. So often you'll be somewhere and, you know, the children of great Rabbonim are there in the yeshiva, or the children of very wealthy people in the yeshiva, and you think, oh, they, you know, these are going to be the future leaders of Klal Yisrael. But from the children of impoverished individuals, that's where the Torah comes. Beautiful, beautiful concept of the Gemara. And we've seen it many, many times over and over throughout the Jewish world, is that those that come from humble beginnings are the ones that achieve great things and become great leaders within Klal Yisrael. And the Gemara says, you know, don't dismiss them or write them off. That would be foolish, because those are going to be the ones who are going to carry the torch into the next generation. And there's a very famous story about there's this Soloveitchik dynasty within Klal Yisrael. The Soloveitchiks were a great people, and they've had throughout many decades great Talmid Chachamim and great Rosh Yeshivas. And the founder of the Soloveitchiks, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was a businessman. He was in Europe, and he was a very wealthy man, and he supported many institutions. And then he went insolvent. He lost his money. And Rav Chaim Voloshin said, how could this be? Somebody who's so generous and who so many institutions in Eastern Europe depend upon has lost his money. And he then went to the Beis Midrash, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and became a tremendous Talmid Chacham himself. And from him came the great Beis Halevi and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and the Brisker Rav and Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik of YU and the great Soloveitchiks, who are the Rosh Yeshivas and the Brisker Yeshivas today in Israel. And Rav Chaim Voloshin said, Hashem wanted him to lose his money in order his children will be B'nai Aniyim. Torah, so they would fulfill this Gemara, so that the Torah would come through there, which is an amazing story within Jewish history. We thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.